Presenting the transcription feature...
From crisis to crisis.
Hey everybody, welcome back to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. I am Michael Bailey.
I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And once again, we are here to hop in the Wayback Machine and look at the From Crisis to Crisis era of Superman, which started in Man of Steel number 1 and ends in Adventures of Superman number 649 in Infinite Crisis. This week, we're taking a look at the Superman books published under the January 1987 cover date, starting with Superman number 1, which was released on October 9th, 1986.
The title of the issue is Heart of Stone. It was written by John Byrne, penciled by John Byrne, with ink by Terry Austin. It was lettered by John Costanza and colored by Tom Zhu. How do you pronounce that guy's name?
I have no idea. I've been saying Ziuko.
And edited by Andy Helper. The three different Superman books that were coming out at the time all covered a different aspect of Superman. The actual Superman book that was titled Superman number 1 tended to focus on Superman himself, less so on, say, for instance, Clark Kent. Now, the renumbering of the series is an important thing to note. First off, this is Superman issue number 1. The last issue of Superman was Superman number 423, which became Adventures of Superman, which we'll be talking about in just a minute. But that way they could go back and have a Superman number 1. What happened in this story, it takes place 3 months after Man of Steel number 6, Superman begins by breaking into an industrial complex because he's trying to track down his spaceship that he arrived to Earth on. He finds a lot of Superman information on the computers in the complex, and he also finds a dead body who is Dr. Vale, and we can now reveal that he was indeed the shadowy figure in Man of Steel number 1 and the guy who took the photograph in Man of Steel number 4. So since there's so much information about Superman in there, Superman decides to cut around the Earth where the complex is, pick the whole thing up, and fly it out into space. He leaves the whole thing out in space where it will not be disturbed or discovered by anybody else, since there's all this information about Superman there, and goes off to go jogging as Clark Kent with Lois Lane. Lois and Clark flirt with each other a little bit. It's light flirting, but it's established that she's still holding a grudge about Clark Kent getting the Superman story 7 years ago. That's a long time to hold a grudge. It is. They see a robbery in progress, and they run into John Corbin, who is actually Metallo. He's a classic character from the Superman mythos, but this is his first appearance in the modern day. Clark Kent is thrown behind a... Clark is thrown behind a desk in the bank where he changes into Superman, and he fights Corbin. He realizes that Corbin is pretty tough, and he also feels pretty weak. There's a flashback sequence. It goes throughout a lot of the issue, the flashback sequence, where Dr. Vale... explains to John Corbin about turning him into Metallo and about the kryptonite that is basically his heart. It's fueling his body. It was uranium, but kryptonite is apparently much more powerful. Plus, it obviously weakens Superman. So Superman starts to lose the fight. There's a cutaway to Lex Luthor, who is now completely bald. So just as Metallo, his skin has been ripped off and he looks much more like the Terminator. He's about to kill Superman, and there's a flash, and the fight is over. Metallo is gone. And I'll give you three guesses on who has the kryptonite, but you're only going to need one.
Artie Lang.
Nice guess. Artie Lang?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, go ahead.
Completely random joke. No, I
How to Be Completely Random by Michael Bailey.
Well, it's better than being part of the non sequitur society. We may not make sense, but we sure like pizza.
And fish.
When I first read this issue, which was a good year or so after it came out, I completely fell in love with it. Rereading it now, and I've reread it a couple times over the years, but rereading it now feels more like an establishing issue than it should. But having said that, I really liked the opening. I thought the internal monologue he was having was great. I loved the callback to Man of Steel number 4, and you actually see the picture that was taken. Finding the bodies a little creepy to me. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, when it came to finding the body, what got to me the most was the fact that he's Superman. He enters this complex and looks around for a while, then finds a body saying, oh, it's been... this person has been dead for 6 weeks, yet with all of his super senses, he couldn't smell a rank dead body from 6 weeks ago.
I also liked the fact that when he was looking around the place and he found the vat of acid that Emmett Vale had obviously put John Corbin's remains in after transplanting the brain into the cybernetic body, that Superman's kind of like, huh, acid, not strong enough to hurt me. Oh, my God, skin. There's bone in there. I just put my hand in that. I got to bathe for a week now.
Well, that's how I would feel about it.
God knows. Well, if I touched acid, it would more like be ow, 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 ow. Get it off, get it off, get it off.
Don't run it underwater.
Exactly. We got more of the telekinetic... We got more of the eventually aborted telekinetic aspect to Superman's powers that John Byrne was trying to establish, as I explained last episode.
And I'll tell you right now that when you're going back and reading these, if you've already read stuff that's happened afterwards, it just doesn't make any sense.
What do you mean?
About Superman, the telekinetic powers.
Oh, and yeah.
Things
really
feel
lighter
when I fly them as opposed to when I lift them. I mean, I sort of understand where he was going with that, but it didn't actually go anywhere.
Yeah, and that's kind of unfortunate, because like I explained last episode, that would have been kind of cool. But, you know, this is how comic books happen. It happens because, you know, things happen because the artist or writer loses interest. It happens because editorial comes down and goes, no, you can't do that. Apparently, from what I understand, Byrne kind of had a running gun battle with the higher-ups at DC, which resulted in Dick Giordano at one point telling him that, and this I got from a Wizard article back in 1995, that there was a difference between the Superman he was writing and the one they were merchandising. So you kind of got to feel bad for John on that, because he was brought in to do a very specific thing and was willing to work within their framework. They push for the hard reboot, he does it, and then they start immediately backing off. And that's why I think that telekinetic aspect to his abilities was dropped so early, because I don't think it's really mentioned beyond this issue. I mean, I'll find out.
We'll talk about that next episode, probably.
You mentioned that Lois and Clark were flirting with each other. I find it more antagonistic on her side.
He was definitely flirting with her, and it was...
Oh.
Their jogging date was more of a date than you would expect between two coworkers.
Oh, very much so, because he had to work for it.
And then he was late.
Yeah, only 4 minutes, but remember, in 4 minutes a lot can happen, as she points out. And I like the fact that that's what Lois does.
Yeah. How long does it did it take for the Hindenburg to blow up, or for Oswald to shoot Kennedy,
or for Superman to save a bunch of people? It was just. It's like real world. Hey, we're in the DC universe.
Oh yeah.
But I love the interplay between the two of them, because she, what does she call him? She calls him something which he takes above swine, which is what she called him in issue 4 of Man of Steel. And he's like, well, I'll take that as an improvement. She goes, suit yourself.
Yeah, no. Calling him a weasel.
Yeah, a weasel. A weasel is apparently better than swine.
Yeah.
But even so, he's still thinking, you know, I got to keep working at this. She's got to fall in love with me as Clark.
And he's still very much trying to get her to fall in love with Clark. He's not trying to get her to fall in love as Superman. She's already, in a sense, in love with Superman. I say in a sense because she doesn't really know him. If she did, she would know that he was Clark Kent, too.
But this was also the tight continuity between Man of Steel number 6 and this issue.
Right.
Man of Steel number 6, he makes a decision to go after her, and now we're seeing the fruits of his efforts. And, you know, he's sitting there in all sweats. She's in shorts. I mean, she's there for a date. I'm sorry.
Okay, fair enough.
That's just my opinion.
Well, I figure he's emails in about sweats. That. You can see the muscles beneath his sweats. But
yeah.
I assume that that's the reason why he's wearing them, is to try and hide that off. I mean, he's always in a suit. You don't see him very often in a bathrobe.
It would have been funny for him to show up in, like, a pair of shorts and a wife beater. Just like, hello, Lois.
That would be in the Brian Michael Bendis version.
No, what I'm saying is, like, in the pilot of Lois and Clark, where he shows up to the door wearing nothing but a towel.
Right, okay.
And she goes, I thought you'd be naked, ready. I mean, I don't know why I thought that line was so funny. It really was.
Oh, but it was really funny. I love Pilot to Lois and Clark is unfortunately about the best that it ever got. It stayed good for certain episodes, but man, that pilot was just incredible. And it so harkens back to this era.
When they rush into the bank, which, you know, it's very comic bookish. It's like, hey, we're jogging along. A bank robbery. When they run in, Clark is at first like, hey, maybe we should call the cops. You know, he's playing mild-mannered, but he's not being a weakling about it.
Right.
He's being cautious, and she chides him about the fact that, you know, he's like, Perry's warning you about this. And she's like, Perry White was the biggest ambulance chaser of his day. And when they run in and they are confronted by John Corbin, one, I'm surprised he didn't snap her wrist. Because I don't know how much control he has over his strength. But Clark punches him in the stomach. And it's like Clark Kent, man of action. And what I liked is, again, Clark gets knocked out because he's only human. But he tries. And I think that is so much preferable to him just going, I'm going to fall down and pretend to be like this weakling. I like the fact that, you know, well, I'm going to try something. And I'm going to get knocked back, Bill Bixby in the Incredible Hulk style, so I can change.
Right, and that comes to even more of a head in the next issue we're going to be talking about. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but Adventures of Superman 424, which is the next one that we're going to be talking about this episode, something kind of like that happens with him and Cat Grant.
Yeah. I like the fact that when Metallo is fighting Superman and we're seeing his flashbacks, that he sees in green.
Like,
I don't know why he would see in green to start, but it's like everything now is through this hazy kryptonite view.
Well, you know what those flashbacks make me think of?
What?
That sequence in RoboCop where they keep on turning him on and then back off.
I love this guy!
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And then New Year's Eve where they turn him on by accident or something.
And they put a party on him and she kisses him, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
but that's kind of what that makes me think of. It's not a direct correlation, but...
No, because this came out about a year before RoboCop, so...
I thought RoboCop was in 1986.
87.
Was it 87? Okay.
It was 87.
I'm behind on my Verheiden.
But things that were kind of referenced here is, and you said it, I'm sorry, that cybernetic Metallo looks like Terminator.
He does look like Terminator, but then again, that's definitely a step up from the original, from the first appearance in Superboy. I don't remember which issue. I have it mentioned somewhere in a review, probably in the episode, the Metallo episode. Where he was, he looked more like C-3PO more than anything else. And I much prefer Terminator, the endoskeleton, to C-3PO.
Or Scott Valentine from Lois and Clark.
Oh, let's not go there. Season 2, bad parts of it. Okay.
Lex really didn't have too much to do in this issue, but I liked where he was.
He was only the fact.
Yeah, I like the fact that somebody comes in and says, "Hey, boss, some palooka is beating up Superman. He says he's going to kill him." And Lex is like, "Nope, nobody's going to kill him but me."
In fact, the palooka who comes in looks a lot like the punk rock girl who Superman saved from a mugging in Man of Steel 2.
Well, it's good that she found a vocation and a career.
Maybe Superman set her on the right path.
See, that's one of the aspects of Man of Steel that dates the series. Somebody walking down the street with a boombox on their shoulder.
And what's interesting about that is that that was supposed to be, what, 1978,
1979? Yeah.
If you actually look at it chronologically, it's not hugely important. It was still published in the 80s, so I'm willing to let that one go. But I just thought I would point that out. The kryptonite that's used in John Corbin's body, that is the same piece, again, from that hit the ship in the beginning of Man of Steel. Again, keep an eye on that. That's the only piece of kryptonite that exists for quite a while. Eventually more is found, but for quite a while, because John Byrne was trying to cut out kryptonite, a rare item as opposed to something that you find all over the planet and it can kill Superman. It really just is the one thing, and we'll be following that as we talk about it.
It was interesting to see him feel weak for the first time in the series. I mean, he fought Bizarro, he got hit by Bizarro's heat vision, and he felt pain. But he felt dizzy, he was getting bruised and badly beaten, and he just doesn't know what's going on.
Right, he's only been affected by kryptonite one time, and he had no idea what it was, and that, again, was in Man of Steel number one. This is only his second time being affected by it, and he still doesn't know what it was. He can't see it. But he did feel weakened, and eventually weakened to the point that Metallo could basically beat the crap out of him. He almost killed him.
Yes, he did.
And Metallo also, this is important, he did explain that kryptonite specifically drains Superman's solar reserves.
That's kind of weird.
It is kind of weird, because the idea there is that if he's affected by kryptonite at night, he won't go back to being Superman until he gets normal yellow sunlight daylight.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far. I think it's just John Byrne set up in the very first issue of Man of Steel the reason why Krypton blowed up real good is that the metals in the planet were fusing into a new radioactive one, and that same pressure was what caused the planet to go boom.
Right.
So he establishes right then and there that kryptonite is radioactive because it's radioactive. So to then have it come to Earth, I think this is one of the few times where Byrne overanalyzed something to a fault.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, well, it's radioactive, and it's radioactive because of this happened. And now, because he gets all his powers from solar radiation, this will drain those stores, and he will... No, it should affect him first and foremost, because he's connected to that planet. He is a Kryptonian. Therefore, biologically, on a genetic level, you know, with Laura and Jor-El being his parents, they have lived with the Green Death. And even though their biological functions and everything are taken care of by their suits, you gotta think that that's gonna muck with your DNA on some level and pass something down. But maybe I'm trying to overthink this. I don't know.
I was about to say you're complaining about Burn overthinking things.
Yeah, but you see, I'm right. Everyone else is wrong.
I think it's also important to point out that this is the first time that Lois Lane discovers that Superman is an alien. At this point, the only people who know that are Lex Luthor and Superman, and probably the Kents off page.
Yeah, I would assume that after he flew to the mountains and had his deep, meaningful thought at the end of Man of Steel number 6, that he went home and had to break the news to Martha and Jonathan. And knowing how this Martha and Jonathan were characterized, it didn't make a darn bit of difference.
Probably not. I mean, they were happy with him as a Russian baby. I'm sure that an alien is, like, better.
I would like the scene because Jonathan in Man of Steel number 1 makes the joke, well, maybe he's an alien, and Martha goes, you and your pulp magazines. I wanted to be a fly on the wall in the scene where he goes, well, I am an alien, and Jonathan stands up and goes, see, I was right. You told me I was silly. You owe me pie. That's what I want. That's what I want to see.
Unfortunately, our pie did die.
There are several first appearances in this issue, John Corbin. Kryptonite proper, you know, I guess you could say that the first appearance would be in Man of Steel number 1, because you kind of see the chunk go into the ship and everything, but this is where it is named. And it's kind of weird. They, you know, Byrne explains through the dialogue that Emmett Vale was able to decipher the Kryptonian language. So this guy's a freaking genius. One. And two, learns that it comes from the planet Krypton. Not so much a genius that he doesn't then read on to see that Superman is not the vanguard of alien invasion, but, you know, he's crazy and probably dying of kryptonite poisoning, as we'll see soon.
Well, but Bale, if he was reading Kryptonese, probably also discovered, oh my goodness, this is English. With symbols standing in place of each individual letter.
Well, today
I know.
No. This is actually an interesting fact. Today we have the Kryptonian language as has been popularized on Smallville and has been used annoyingly by Jeff Loeb every once in a while in Superman, Batman. And at least now they're actually translating for it instead of giving us pages of Kryptonian dialogue that I guess we're meant to decipher.
I actually started with Superman Batman number 8, where Supergirl showed up and started speaking Kryptonese and tried to translate that and figured, okay, I will keep trying to translate this every time that they do it, but I never did it again.
The Kryptonese that you saw in issue 6 of Man of Steel, and you see as far ahead as Panic in the Sky, which happened in 1992, was an actual language that I believe E. Nelson Bridwell, who was an editor, assistant editor on the Superman books in the 50s and 60s, and eventually wrote a bunch of the Superman stories that appeared around that time. He was, until his death in 1987, pretty much the foremost authority on the Silver Age and Bronze Age Superman, because he was there when it was all created. And apparently he came up with a Kryptonian language that was incredibly complex, and that's what they use, I believe, until the current one became very popular. So there is my Now You Know fact for the episode.
Two last, in some cases, personal things. I do have the ad inside of my copy of Superman number 1. It's still in there. It says, rarer than kryptonite, and it's for the first trade paperback of the Man of Steel miniseries that you could send away for. It was in all three of the issues this month. For me, it's only in my copies of Superman and the Action Comics. It's not in my Adventures of Superman issue.
I'm kind of in the same boat as you are. They were all labeled individually as well. The one in Superman had the Superman logo. The one in Adventures had the Adventures of Superman lettering, and the Action Comics had the Action Comics one. I have the one in Superman and Action as well. Mine's missing from Adventures of Superman, which means we don't have pristine mint copies, and they are therefore useless.
Yeah, they're only worth $2.99 now.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to mention is the cover for Superman number one. I am not a big fan of this cover. I find it to be just a little bit bland. You can sort of see Metallo, and there's some sort of a computer degradation on it that's done on purpose to show that he has kryptonite in his chest and showing Superman in pain. And the background color is entirely yellow. It's not a bad cover. I think it's a halfway decent cover, but as a number one, I think they could have done more than this.
Probably, but you know, it's pretty epic, and I like the lettering on it. It's your first issue, Superman, and it could be your last.
That's true. No, that
in my cup,
been an upgrade.
In my copy, which was a direct edition copy, which there are differences between the two, mostly in the where the cover price is, where the UPC symbol would go, it says Adventures of Superman number 424 is coming.
I have the same one.
Yeah, a lot of DC books did this at the time to kind of preview the other big things that were coming up in their line.
But by the time we get to the issue we're going to be talking about in a few minutes, the Action Comics one, it says the history of the DC Universe is must reading, but my Adventures of Superman, which we're going to be talking about in 30 seconds, I have a UPC symbol.
So you have the newsstand edition.
I guess I do.
And if you look at the way the cover price and the numbering is, there are two different ways of doing it. It's smaller in the direct market.
I see what you're saying. And the Comics Code Authority seal of approval is in a different spot.
Okay, next up is Adventures of Superman number 424, titled Man of War. This was released on October 16th, 1986. Written by Marv Wolfman, penciled by Jerry Ordway, inked by Mike Macklin, and has the same lettering, coloring, and editing team as the other issues. This one is a little denser than either the Superman or Action. That is not a slight on either of those issues. It's just Marv Wolfman's writing style kind of lends itself to having very, very dense story and dialogue, kind of like he was kind of like the Chris Claremont of DC, really. In the beginning of the issue, Lois Lane is visiting her sick mother, and we get to see some of her family dynamic. We cut to a gentleman of Middle Eastern descent in a meeting that goes rather poorly, and he informs the people at the meeting that their treatment of him and his country is not going to go unnoticed. He leaves, and the building is immediately attacked by a giant robot. Cut to the Daily Planet, where Clark Kent meets Cat Grant for the first time, and the two immediately go out for some lunch, it seems. Lois talks with Perry about her family problems. On the way to the lunch, another robot attacks City Hall. Cat Grant and Clark Kent apparently forget about lunch altogether and go to meet Dr. Emil Hamilton, who tests out a new invention. When Clark gets wind of the robot attacking City Hall, he flies off, fights it for a little bit, talks to Inspector Bill Henderson, and immediately goes back into battle. Meanwhile, Lois has been kind of kidnapped by Lex Luthor, and eventually agrees to have dinner with him, where he reveals that he is aware of her mother's condition and has devised a cure. And at the end of the issue, she leaves, and Lex kind of gloats over his victory. I love this cover.
Oh, yeah. No, this cover is so much better than the Superman number one cover, which I was talking about before. I think it's a really, it's a decent cover. But it's not what I would want from a number one, you know, the first time back out of the gate, basically. This, the Adventures of Superman cover, is what I expect. And I know that that's a take on, which issue was it? Superman number 14, I think it was?
I believe it is, yeah. The image they used back in 2001 for a Support Our Troops poster. I'm going to eat a little crow here, and it's, you know, several decades after the fact, but it still doesn't matter. When I was a kid, I really didn't like Jerry Ordway's art. I wanted John Byrne because I was a kid and I didn't know no better. But now, you know, 20-some-odd years later, I look at this cover and I'm like, wow, he had such an iconic take on this character. I mean, the symbol looks good. You know, he's got the eagle coming on to the arm. You even got the Twin Towers in the background, oddly enough.
If you take a look at page 12, there's this really nice huge splash page of Superman flying, not really doing anything specifically iconic, but just the way that he's drawn is just incredible. It's from a really nice angle. There's an American flag in the background. He is not looking at the camera, so it's not a take on Christopher Reeve. I said the camera. He's not looking out of the page. He's looking down.
Either way is fair. No, I think, given how Clark Kent kind of is very muted in this issue, he's not the 80s hunk that Byrne kind of draws him as, with his sleeves rolled up and everything. So having Clark Kent be so in so many small panels, and then having the first image of Superman be this gigantic, bombastic, except for Cat Grant in the upper left-hand corner, it's just like, okay, guys, bam, here's Superman. And you got to have a feeling, and I don't know if this is true or not, that Ordway just had a ball doing that as his first big Superman picture.
Well, one of the things that I talk about to differentiate the early years of The Adventures of Superman and Superman split, especially with the new numbering, which I'm pretty sure that I talked about that when we were doing the episode originally.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
But the big difference between the Superman and Adventures is that Superman really did focus more on the character of Superman, stories around him. And Adventures of Superman, it definitely had Superman in it. I can't think of any of these early issues that didn't have Superman in it, but it really did focus on Clark Kent, Lois Lane, Cat Grant, stuff like that, secondary characters. And I think this focused more on Clark Kent's story than it did, not necessarily more than it did on Superman, but this was the Clark Kent book.
It was more directly influenced by the Adventures of Superman 50s series than Superman. And, you know, Action, we'll get into that in a second, but Action was its own little acre in the Superman 40-acre woods. So, but no, I have to agree with you. It's just, you know, Wolfman did more really to establish the Daily Planet as a family of characters that was carried on in his absence. When he left the series, eventually the supporting cast became pretty much just as important as Superman, and a lot of that groundwork was laid here.
Well, speaking of family, the introduction to Lois Lane's family in the first page of the book, it shows off just how dysfunctional their family is. We've already been introduced to Lucy in Man of Steel number 5, but here we meet Sam Lane and Ellie Lane, the mother and father. Now, the mother's in a coma from a chemical explosion, but it's clear from the dialogue that nobody in the family really gets along. Like, Lois and Lucy kind of get along, I guess, but it's implied that even Sam and Ellie, husband and wife, do not get along very well when she was well.
Yeah, you get the sense that, I mean, it's very telling that Lois doesn't even call her dad, father, or dad, or whatever. She calls him Sam. And that's just, you know, right then and there, without going into any backstory, you know that these two don't get along.
The Kents get along really well, but the Lanes do not. So it will be interesting, of course, when they finally clash for the first time.
It was played more for comedic purposes then, though. It really was.
That's true. There were some funny episodes of Lois and Clark, I think, that involved the parents of both Lois and Clark.
Yeah, and that was a completely different paradigm, too. It wasn't the farmer meeting the ex-general. It was the farmer meeting the kooky scientist.
Moving on to Cat Grant. We have introduction to Cat Grant here. I like Cat Grant a lot.
She became pretty indispensable to the cast.
She did. She very much did. And this is her first appearance ever, not just in this series.
Okay.
Now, Clark flirting with Kat, that is a little bit surprising for a lot of the new readers, I would guess. I thought Clark Kent's clumsiness was supposed to be fake, but he clearly likes Cat Grant, and so he gets his leg caught in the elevator. Now, you would think that Clark Kent would have more control over his body and his movements, especially since he could topple a building if he moved the wrong way, but he does in fact fall all over himself around her. Now, Lois implies that basically that Cat Grant is a slut.
Yes. Yes, she does.
Not in those exact words. Let's see, what she said was, I've heard how you get some of those interviews. And she says back, you don't hear them complaining, do you, Miss Lane?
No, Kat was...
Or me, for that matter.
Kat was very much designed to be the other romantic foil for Superman. And instead of kind of the triangle being Clark, Superman, and Lois, it really became Clark, Lois, and Kat.
Which is an interesting way to do it. It's an interesting thing.
Because Kat liked Clark.
Yes.
It's like her opinion of Superman, she liked Superman, obviously, but I think she liked Superman in the way that everybody in Metropolis, you know, likes Superman. It's like, hey, he's our guy, you know, even though she's new to town. But she walks in and she sees Clark and, you know, obviously the kind of bookworm thing does it for her, I guess.
I guess so. And also, if you notice, she has a thought bubble that reveals that Clark Kent is also a novelist.
Yes.
She was not talked about Steel.
That was a very big deal at the time as well. Many people who had problems with Man of Steel, from what I understand in reading, as I've said before, letters pages to fanzines at the time and such, is that Clark being successful in his own right was a problem for some people. They didn't like that. They wanted him to be the mild-mannered reporter. And Byrne and here Wolfman firmly established that not only was he a reporter, but he did other things in writing that made him respected and probably afforded him a pretty cushy lifestyle.
They did something really interesting by making him a reporter because he wants to do something without his powers that he can be praised for as well, something that he can be successful at without using his powers, because he could be the world's best doctor or fireman, something like that. He could be a sports star if he wanted to, but instead he chose to be a reporter specifically because he can be successful at it as Clark Kent without use of his powers. Obviously, he does occasionally end up using his powers, like X-ray vision, things like that. But and so to be a novelist as well, I prefer that to the old version, the what I would think of as the Golden and Silver Age version, where he's a reporter because that lets him get to...
Gives him first crack at the disasters?
It does give him first crack at the disasters, basically.
Yeah, and
Which is helpful, but...
Well, yeah, because it's a good way to get a story started. I mean, especially on the radio show.
I think this is a better reason to make him a reporter for the Daily Planet.
Well, eventually they do kind of establish that he had a knack for writing very young. And when you think about that and think about him gravitating towards journalism, even though he did play football in high school, and especially when he went to Metropolis University, he majored in journalism. And it's a natural extension then to have him go, well, I like to write, I'm going to write fiction. Because it is common for reporters to have a sideline writing job of writing books and such. Of course, eventually they get to the remainder table, but that's years down the road.
Right. So, yeah, also, if you look at, I know that Jim Lehrer, who does the news for PBS, he has written, I'm not even sure how many novels, something like 15 or 20.
This issue is very 80s. Of the three books that came out in January 1987, this is the one where I feel it is definitely 1987.
Because especially when you look at that one line, it's at the bottom of page 15. Superman's just apparently been smushed by a robot, and the cops are saying, we need reinforcements, and one of them says, oh, like who? The Ghostbusters? Rambo? Schwarzenegger? Sigourney Weaver?
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that at the end of the issue, he's perched upon a movie marquee that says Stallone and Cobra, and her sisters. This was a very kind of, Marv Wolfman, for lack of a better term, kind of came from that Stan Lee school of writing, where you throw in as many current pop culture references as you can. When you read Superman number one, what you essentially have is Superman finding this place that has a bunch of computer systems and all this information about him, and then he goes jogging, and then he fights Metallo. There is nothing in that you couldn't take that exact same story and do it right now. There's nothing in the dialogue that makes it seem like this is 1987, or 1986 in this case.
But adding those pop culture references, I think that's an attempt to make it hip and cool for the time, as opposed to something that you look back on and say, oh, well, that's obviously 80s.
That's true. I mean, it was very much to let you know that this is the modern Superman. I'm just saying that in terms of reading it now, it takes me into the story just a little bit. Not a lot, because I love this issue, and I love the next the second part of the story. But it's just, I read that, I was like, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, Sigourney Weaver was an action hero back then, wasn't she?
That's right, she was.
Wolfman's Lex Luthor is a lot more subtle than Burns. Burns is very much, I'm the villain, and I kind of like that out of that aspect of Lex Luthor. Like, he is the one that will sit back and kind of be kind of the Dr. Doom and refer to himself in the third person. Wolfman's take on the character is much more, I'm going to play you. And in the end, you're going to come to my way of thinking because you think it's the way it should be, not because I forced you.
And, of course, he's completely manipulating Lois. We find out by the end that he was the one behind the chemical explosion that is the reason that her mother is in a coma and going to die. He's developed a serum that Lois's mother can take, and it will allow her to live, and she'll have to take more of it each month, which means that every month Lois Lane basically will have to go groveling to Lex Luthor or go and see him. And, of course, he is in love with her, as in love with her as Lex Luthor knows how to love, basically.
Do you think he's in love with her, or it's more of she is the prize he cannot have?
That may well be part of it, and I much prefer this, too. I remember in the first episode of Superman the Animated Series, it was established that Lex and Lois used to date.
Yes.
In the Animated Series, not in the comics. But then they never really did much with that.
Well, you kind of get the feeling, taking that theory and running with it, is that if he ever got Lois, he would lose complete interest in her.
Probably.
Because then she isn't the strong-willed opponent that needs to be defeated and crushed. Luthor, in Wolfman's 12-issue run on Adventures of Superman, seems to be happier working behind the scenes than really getting his hands dirty in any of the affairs. Like, he is, for lack of a better term...
I really like that about his Luthor, though.
Yeah, he's kind of the kingpin. I mean, it's an easy thing to say. It's something that has been said for 20 you know, 25 years at this point, I guess you could say, almost. But fact of the matter is, there are two bald criminal masterminds that hide behind the facade of legitimate businessmen.
And they're very manipulative.
Exactly.
To in often cases, very evil ends. I mean, what Lex is doing to Lois here and what he's done to her family is downright evil. And he's so calm about it.
Yeah, it's just like, I'm just going to wait. It's all going to come to me. It's all good. Everything's fine.
And this woman who he's talking to at the end, I'm not even sure if dear Lilia.
Yes, she one of his many female assistants.
Yes. I haven't read on, and I haven't read these issues in a long time, but I did read this one for the sake of the podcast, obviously. I haven't read on. I don't remember if she comes back.
No, she's kind of like the punk girl at the end of Superman number one. You just get the feeling that Luther just goes through, like he has like a Kleenex box of attractive female assistants. And you look, you know, at the end there, he's caressing her cheek.
That he is.
And it's very much the, you know, I am the alpha male and even my assistants are here for my every whim.
Do you think that was in the notes that they would put Lex Luthor with a different female assistant in every issue or something?
I don't know, but it would make sense.
Every time he can keep one.
It would make sense, even you know, if that was the case. We're gonna go into depth next month about one of the few female workers that Lex Luthor had that had any kind of legs beyond their one appearance, but. Yeah, I don't, you know, even at, I'm going to jump ahead real quick, even at the end of Action, when Lex is in Paris, he's got an assistant there who is completely different than any of the other assistants.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole purpose for this one to even be here, so she doesn't need to come back, is that it's to expound on the fact that Lois is the fact that Lex is the one responsible for Lois's mother's condition, and that he is masterminding the whole thing.
It is a lot better than him sitting there musing to himself
with a thought bubble.
Now
I have her.
Exactly. It's just very much like you get the sense that his assistants are like, well, why did you do that? Like, I expected you to totally do something else. No, kitten. As he pats her on the cheek.
Because realistically, he probably wouldn't tell his female assistants.
Yeah, they're there for a reason. And they're either there to be eye candy or something a little stronger than eye candy.
One more thing that we do need to mention. Were you going to go on about that?
No, I was just going to... I figured we'd move into email.
Yeah, I was about to say, Emil Hamilton.
Yes. First appearance in the comics.
First appearance. And, man, we're going to go through quite an arc with him over the course of this podcast.
Very much so, yes. This, you know, of all of the supporting characters that were created for the new Superman, Catherine Grant and Emil, and eventually... You know, their, you know, Bibbo and even Emil's girlfriend, who is just forgotten at one point.
Yeah, you know, she's just gone at one point. I don't remember there even being an exit of any sort.
You know, Emil is kind of like the friend that you just forget about every once in a while, and he shows back up, and you're like, oh yeah, he was gone, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he can help me. They did use him in the animated series, and they also used him in Lois and Clark, but they only did that for one episode. They kind of they sort of abused the idea, brought it in for a one-off episode, and then when they realized, oh, we want an Emil Hamilton character, they brought in Dr. Klein. So when they show up in Suicide Slum, where Professor Hamilton lives and has his lab, he shows them this force field that he's created, and even Superman, he traps Clark in it, and Clark Kent cannot get out of it. He tries to punch through the force field, not using a good amount of strength, and actually feels his hand hurting. Now, the purpose of the force field, the reason Professor Hamilton was creating it, was to cover the entire continental United States in this force field. I suppose to keep out missiles. Can you think of any other reasons?
No, it was very much, you know, this being 1986, where Ronald Reagan was president, and the Star Wars, the SDI initiative, where we would have missiles in space knocking out missiles. This fit right into the fear that, you know, global thermonuclear war was imminent at any time. So
it's also
oddly enough, reading it now, given what happened over the last 8 years with, you know, the former President Bush trying to bring back that kind of system, it's oddly resonant in a weird kind of way.
Like, I hadn't really thought about it like that.
Like, you could do this now and it would make sense. People would be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. We want to keep missiles out. We want to protect ourselves from the threat of global terrorism. And it's odd how some things, like we were talking about before, like, you know, Sigourney Weaver kind of don't make much sense, but how some things from the past can. And Professor Hamilton was, if I'm correct, was created kind of as a one-off character here and in the next issue. And then later on, after Marv Wolfman had left, and Byrne was pretty much solely in charge of writing the character with Jerry Ordway co-plotting Adventures of Superman, they're like, well, we need kind of the goofy scientist character. And, well, we got this guy, Professor Hamilton. And really, Hamilton didn't start coming into his own until Byrne left, which is kind of odd that he's introduced all the way back here.
Yeah.
But that's just because I'm weird.
And the issue does end on a cliffhanger to be continued. We'll talk about that in the next episode.
Yeah, with Clark fighting the Freedom League. But yeah, the Freedom League is the bad guy that's not the bad guy. They're kind of weird. At one point, you see that you get the feeling that the robots operate on mind power. And at one point, a person dies, and you see the director inside of his little control bank, like, you know, sorry about him. I knew he meant a great deal to you, to this woman. She's like, he knew the rules, powering up. And it's just like, wow, they're fanatics. That's great.
The order that these came out are not necessarily the order that they take place in. If you look at the trade for Man of Steel Volume 2, which collects these and the other ones that we'll be talking about over the next two episodes, puts them in order so that there's Superman number 1, then the Action Comics issue we're about to get into, then Superman number 2, followed by both of the following Adventures of Superman.
Which is kind of wrong when you think about it, because when Cat Grant and Clark Kent are at the Daily Planet office, that's where he gets the call from Gunderson from Action Comics number 584.
Okay, I did not know that.
Yeah, if you look at page...
I don't have all of the comics out here. It's just in Adventures?
Yeah, and on page 6, you see Clark saying, "Yes, Mr. Gunderson, I understand your situation. I'll do what I can to contact Superman for you." And
what do you mean?
After we wrap this up, we'll get into who Mr. Gunderson is and why he becomes kind of a problem.
Okay, I did not catch that. But no, that makes sense. But then Action Comics 584 should take place after Adventures of Superman 425.
Yep, pretty much.
Sorry, I'm not as on the ball today.
That's okay, I'm kind of out of it too, but it's going well.
Okay,
it's going well.
Okay, cool. So I'm just trying to make sure that I'm not talking too slowly either. So fine, I'm getting lost in my thought. First appearance this episode, we have Sam Lane, General Sam Lane. Eleanor Lane, whose nickname is Ellie. We have Cat Grant, first time ever. We also have Emil Hamilton. And, of course, Henderson. It's also interesting to note in this that for Lex Luthor, they kept one small part of the character that he used to be, because he used to be a mad scientist. Now he's a Wall Street billionaire. But he says to Lois about the serum that he created it himself and that he hadn't been in the lab in a long time, so it was nice to get back.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a throwback to when Lex Luthor was a mad scientist.
Yes, creating potions and such. Luthor's origin in this brave new world of Man of Steel was very much, he was a very self-made man. You know, he thought of everything. You know, the start of LexCorp as an empire was his design for a fighter jet called the Lex Wing. And that is how he got a lot of his military contracts and why LexCorp became so diverse. And it really makes him more of a formidable threat when you think about it. I mean, the Kingpin just had a criminal empire and he was the boss. He was intelligent, but Luthor is brilliant.
Yeah, he actually gets government contracts.
Yeah. All right, finally this month we have Action Comics number 584, and as Jeff and I have been tripping around, it is kind of hard to, when you're actually saying the numbers of Adventures of Superman and Action Comics, because they followed each other very closely.
Thank you.
But 584 came out on October 23rd, 1986, written by John Byrne, drawn by John Byrne, inked by Dick Giordano, and lettered, colored, and edited by the same team as the rest of the issues. The title for this issue was Squatter.
And this is the same creative team that was on Man of Steel.
Yep, very same.
So this was probably your favorite one.
Not really.
Not really? Okay.
But we'll get to that in a second.
Okay. The Action Comics was very much the team-up series for a while here, and this was the first one. So in this issue begins, Superman is flying around breaking stuff. He slams his fist into a building and causes a bunch of rubble to fall, and Cyborg of Teen Titans fame sees what's happening. He seems to be sort of incognito, but rips his secret clothing off. I'm not sure how it's secret or anything like that. He even had a hat on. It's a bit silly. And destroys the debris before the people get hurt. Cyborg tries to get Superman's attention and even throws a roof patch at him and really upsets him. Superman brutally beats Cyborg. This fight is brutal. Throws him off of the top of a building, and Cyborg actually is able to save himself by grabbing onto the side of it as he reaches the bottom. So Cyborg calls the Teen Titans, and Darth and Donna Troy are there. You know, I actually forgot at first that his name at this point was Changeling, because I think of him as Beast Boy. Yes.
Well, so you think of him as Beast Boy. I think of him as Changeling.
Okay. Oh, there we are. Changeling shows up as an elephant and knocks Superman down. But Superman, of course, is much stronger than an elephant is and knocks him out in one big throw. He actually grabs his trunk and throws him over, and knocks him out cold. So Superman fights Donna Troy, who is probably the only one who would actually hold any sort of a hope against him. And then there's a quick cut to Jericho, who is teaching sign language. He hears about the fighting and runs off to help. Superman is basically about to kill the Titans when Jericho arrives and takes over Superman's body, because I don't know anything about Jericho. That's pretty much his ability, is to enter somebody else's body. And discovers that there's another mind already in there. So Bill Gates shows up.
I'm sorry, that was great.
Thank you.
He does look like Bill Gates.
He does look like Bill Gates. And he says, "I'm Superman," which would be great to hear Bill Gates say, by the way. Superman had been duped into helping this guy out, as Michael mentioned, that he did get the call in the issue we were just talking about, Adventures of Superman 424, and he went over there to try and help him out, and Gunderson used some sort of a ray on him that caused their personalities to switch, their minds to switch. So Superman was now stuck in Bill Gates' body, basically. Except he was on crutches.
Okay.
Superman gives a huge speech about the handicapped, and the final page is Lex Luthor reading the Daily Planet, realizes that there must be some connection between Clark Kent and Superman. That's going to pay off, I think, in the next issue of Superman.
Yes, it does. Before we get into anything, New Teen Titans 101. It was a title. Teen Titans were a creation of the 60s. They had a series in the 70s, but their immense popularity came in 1980 when Marv Wolfman and George Perez created the New Teen Titans, which consisted of Robin, Kid Flash, Cyborg, who is in this issue, who is Victor Stone, the former Beast Boy who became Changeling and then eventually became Beast Boy again, but in this era he was the Changeling, who's a green-skinned teenager that can morph into animals, Wonder Girl, and Starfire. At this point, when Action 584 was published, the New Teen Titans was very much in flux, like everything in DC after the Crisis. And the three characters you see here were the three main characters running through the title at the time. Operating out of Titan's Tower in the off an island of the Hudson River. And
which is fortunately very close to Metropolis.
But having the Titans be the first guest stars was kind of a big deal because they were a very, very popular book at the time.
It was a great marketing idea, actually, to take a really popular... part of the reason why Superman was redone in this is because his popularity had begun to wane, and New Teen Titans was going really, really strongly. In fact, it was one of the books keeping DC afloat at the time.
Very much so.
So it for their first team-up, that does make a lot of sense to go ahead. It's not really even a team-up. It's more of a versus, but regardless...
Well, let's even be even more fair. It's more of Superman knocking them about. Jericho was another member of the Titans that came in later in Marv Wolfman and George Perez's run. He is a mute who has the mutant ability, yes, DC even had mutants, to basically take over other people's bodies. If he locks eye contact with you, he could take over your body. The reason why he was mute is that he is Deathstroke the Terminator's son, and at one point was being held hostage, and somebody slit his throat. So he's not deaf, though he is working with deaf kids in the story to be very ham-fisted in the moral of the tale.
Well, he heard about the fight over the radio, so...
And he goes into, and you got to think, the kid's got guts. You know, even though he's Deathstroke's kid and could probably take care of himself, here's somebody who's like, I'm going to go take on Superman.
Yeah, no, he runs right out there. And he's the one who basically saves everyone. Because he is about to kill the Titans.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
He's not going to knock them out and leave them and fly away. He's going to kill them.
Yeah, this is Gunderson. Gunderson himself is a very... He's kind of a two-dimensional character, but at the same time, it's compelling because the comments he makes as he's fighting, like, you're not going to push me around anymore to Victor Stone, who makes a comment about wanting his Promethium armor. At the time, they were working in the Titans book, they were working on a new armor made of the substance known as Promethium. So that was, again, an interesting callback to something going on in the really popular book. But and when he gets Wonder Girl, it's creepy. Because he's holding her and he's like, you know, beautiful woman scorned me. You know, a woman like you wouldn't have given me two looks. But now that I have you, there's other things we can do besides fight. And I'm like, ew.
And he's holding her by the throat at that time.
Yeah. So at the same time, Gunderson's the two-dimensional villain, but he's got some depth to him.
A little bit, yeah. Well, I mean, it's just a one-off issue. That's something, actually, that I wanted to mention, is that back out of the gate, after the hiatus from having Superman in Action Comics, Superman, the first issue there, began an ongoing narrative. And Adventures with Superman also began a new ongoing narrative where stuff from Adventures with Superman would continue on. This one, right out of the gate, does a one-off issue that's not going to have any serious repercussions later on down the road. Gunderson does not come back.
No, the only thing about this issue that there's a callback to is the last page where
yes.
Byrne sets it up. But you could have removed that page and you wouldn't have lost anything in this story. And that was because Action Comics... Okay, let me back that up a little second. When they were crafting the new Superman, Byrne was going to get his new number one, and Marv Wolfman was going to take over Action Comics. Well, and there was going to be a team-up book that they were going to name at a later date. So Marv was feeling a little left out because he wasn't getting a new number one, and John was getting, well, frankly, two, you know, between Man of Steel number one and Superman number one. So they decided to give Wolfman another title and to move the team-up book to Action Comics, which makes a lot of sense considering when Action first began publication back in the 30s, it was an anthology book with a variety of characters appearing in it. And this was to replace DC Comics Presents. At some point,
as Action Comics go, this is a very action-oriented book as well.
Very much so. As plans firmed up even more, they're like, you know, we've got this other Superman series that has been around for like 423 issues. Maybe we don't want to lose that numbering. So Wolfman didn't get his new number one at all in the end. But it worked out because Adventures of Superman was a great title and again played more into the George Reeves inspired stories. But Action was from the beginning going to be the, you know, balls to the wall superhero book. Apparently originally going to be written by Alan Moore. I've read that in several places. Don't know if that's true. Kind of glad it didn't work out that way. Nothing against Alan Moore.
Yeah, it would be a very, very different book. I'm not sure what would have happened there. I'm sure they've gotten some interesting stories, but...
Yeah, but it would have completely thrown off the dynamic.
It would have. As good as whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow was... I wouldn't want that every time.
But, you know, I think you and I are in agreement that this is not the weakest issue, but it's the one that you can kind of take or leave in the grand scheme of the story.
It's not that memorable. And, you know, when I went to go back through the issue for the sake of the podcast, I did not remember much of the story at all. I saw Superman doing breaking buildings and stuff like that, and I thought, oh, well, what's going on here? I had read this before, but it's been a long time, and I honestly just don't remember it very well.
And the plot's a little silly. That awesome episode of Smallville notwithstanding, I am not a big mind-swapping fan, as that being the plot either of the story, where, ooh, Superman is not Superman, so he can do things Superman wouldn't normally do. I think it's something that's been very played out. The only reason it was interesting on Smallville when Lionel switched places with Clark was they actually did something with it.
Oh, that was a really good episode.
That was an excellent episode.
Yeah. No, and there were a few good episodes around that as well. And then a couple of bad ones.
But, you know, it's just like, you know, he goes and sees this guy. He goes into a room. He flips a switch, so... Again, it made sense because this guy's not very mobile. But between that and, you know, what you were saying before about the ham-fisted speech that Superman gives at the end of this,
oh my goodness, this issue, it takes up so much. It's like they ran out of page or something like that. It's on the bottom of the page. It's in one panel, and there is so much speech, so much text in this that you can barely see Superman's face sort of off to the side where the word bubbles are coming from. It just wasn't a largely memorable issue when it comes down to it.
Yeah, not bad. Not like I never want to read that again. It was a very good team-up issue, and if you've ever read a lot of DC Comics Presents, it's a very good Superman team-up issue. But, yeah, just outside of that last page leading into Superman number 2, kind of making everything connect, not a whole lot to do with the new Superman. This story could have easily have been told pre-crisis as post-crisis.
Right, and plus it is also a little bit more difficult to do a team-up with Superman because you have to make it something that specifically whoever he's teaming up with would go along with. There aren't really a lot of Superman-centric Superman team-up stories. I would say there aren't a lot of them, but there are probably less of them. Because if you're Superman, why do you need to team up with anybody?
Yeah, pretty much.
There's a reason Superman doesn't have a sidekick. He doesn't need one.
Get in the way, lad, I guess.
I suppose so. Oh, get in the way, Matt. Get in the way, lad. Needs rescuing again. Oh, he's kind of got Lois Lane.
That's true, and Jimmy Olsen. Jimmy Olsen was his pal, kind of his sidekick.
Yeah, but, this turned into a sidekick for a little while.
There were, but there were no real first appearances here. There was a very nice text page in the back where Byrne once again gives you a little background, pulls back the curtain, and explains his take on Action Comics, which was very much the Superman teaming up with other heroes and having adventures. And it was his excuse to use the characters he really liked to use. So thanks again, everybody, for listening to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. Next week, Jeffrey and I will be covering the Superman comics that came out in February 1987.
Well, where that's the cover dates.
The what?
That's the cover dates.
Yeah. Where we have Lex Luthor maybe putting two and two together about Superman and Clark Kent, the resolution of the Freedom League story, and Superman teaming up with the Phantom Stranger in a, once again, largely forgettable story.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not a huge fan of magic in general.
Just a quick reminder, of course, to check out the Superman homepage every day for the latest news and reviews on the Man of Steel. Comic book reviews, Smallville news, movie rumors as it leaks out, even little pieces like the book to the musical It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman getting rewritten is covered. If you have any comments, questions, concerns, fears, trepidations, you can either use the comment feature at the Superman homepage. You can private message us at the homepage as well. Both Jeffrey and myself are members. Just look up our reviews, and you can private message us from there. Or the more direct route, since we are thinking about doing a letters page of sorts, is to is to email us at FromCrisisToCrisis, all one word, at gmail.com. Anything to end the show with there, Jeffrey?
Yes. That was it.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you at the back issue bin.
Superman is a copyrighted feature appearing in Action Comics magazine.